Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, January 19th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Jeff Spillane. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Jeff, the annual return of right whales to Cape Cod Bay kicked off this week with the news that a number of whales were spotted there. The whale population's widely seen as being in a dire condition after a year of high mortality and low births.
That's right, Steve. And typically, we see here in Cape Cod Bay that right whales tend to be in Cape Cod Bay from January through May. This is where they come for feeding and socialization. And the first aerial survey of the whales was held this week on Tuesday, and we've seen 14 of them already, which is, according to the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, a very good start to the season. Typically, we only see a handful at this point in January. And as you had mentioned before, the right whale population is in a dangerous decline. Only 434 in existence on the planet right now. 16 were killed last year, largely due to ship strikes and entanglements. And so it's very important that we keep a good close eye on these right whales.
And last year, not many calves born either. I think that's the other part of that
only
equation.
Yeah, five last year, which is a big concern.
A big concern. And some of this, the damage or the some of the mortality in the population happening here, but a big portion of it, I think 12 deaths last year happening in Canada. And so it's really the whale's not paying attention to national or international boundaries, but the duty to protect them really falling on the governments. And today we had a story out about a lawsuit to protect the whales.
That's right. And after the whales leave here, Steve, they tend to go up to the Bay of Fundy or the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and that's where they hit some trouble last year. And on Thursday, yesterday, there was a lawsuit filed in federal court in Washington. And the charge was against the National Marine Fisheries Service. And the plaintiffs were saying there's not been enough done to prevent the right whale entanglements in lobster gear specifically, and alleges violations of the Endangered Species Act.
And the lobster fishery then becomes sort of exposed in this conversation.
It does. And they're saying, hey, you know, we're really not to blame and we're not going to go away. And, you know, they spoke with the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association about that. But in the lawsuit, the plaintiff was looking for better markings of fishing gear, weaker rope, and some ropeless fishing, and some innovative ways to somehow solve this problem.
Start to protect these whales as they pass through the lobster fishery.
Exactly.
The whales here in Cape Cod Bay, as you say, they come here to feed.
They do.
Typically, and socialize. The story of the whales, I think, is really taking a turn because it's the first time it was really this year, earlier this year, that the scientists have really started to come out and talk about them. I guess it's the end of last year now, that they've come out and started to talk about them using the word extinction.
Exactly. And more specifically, in a story that we have today, it's mentioned extinction in 20 years if some drastic measures aren't taken and taken soon.
That's a fast time frame
for
a species that, again, it's dwindled down to about 434 creatures, and not all of them. Of course, you're dependent on the reproductive females, and they're not producing calves at the rate that they're people would expect them to.
Right, and something else I found interesting from Marianne Bragg's reporting is there's something also called sublethal damage that is being done to the right whale population, and that's the females getting entangled in the fishing gear, and that it's not a fatal entanglement, but they're carrying around this fishing gear. It's weighting them down. They're not gaining enough weight to reproduce. So that's a big issue as well.
So there's stressors in
that's
that
right.
environment that way. Let's talk about the story that we had this week about a provider of mental health services to children and families on Cape Cod announcing that it's going to be shutting down. This appears to leave a real hole in services for folks.
It does. This is the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children. It may sound like it's a state agency, but it's not, Steve. It's a private nonprofit. They do have an office in Hyannis. It's the only office they have on the Cape and Islands. And they've announced that they're going to be closing in early March. Simply because they can't afford to keep it open any longer. They're running at an unsustainable deficit, about $300,000 to $400,000 per year. A reason being is low mass health reimbursement. About 95% of their clients, they have 120 families, are on mass health. Of course, that's the public insurance program here in the state. And the reimbursement just doesn't cover the cost of them keeping their doors open.
So these are families that are already financially in need of services,
exactly.
And now there's going to be one less service provider for them.
That's right, and it's also it's going to cost about 18 or 19 of their employees their jobs.
Mm.
The society right now is approaching other nonprofits to see if they can take on their clients and employees. And one of the big programs that the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children has taken on in the past few years is providing training for teachers as to how to deal with students affected by the opioid crisis, and also working with grandparents who are raising their grandchildren who have been affected by this as well. So it will be quite a gap year.
It's interesting. I saw in this article noted that a lot of providers of mental health services now don't even accept, they prefer not to take any insurance at all. They'd rather people pay out of pocket.
Yeah, that's right. And that was a survey done by the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation that many are just not accepting public insurance or insurance at all, as you just mentioned.
Now, you say that 19 of these folks are going to be out of business, or out of work, rather, from this agency closing, 18 or 19. Is there an opportunity for them around here?
There is, because there's going to be a job fair coming up. I believe it may be in the next week. And so some of the nonprofits will certainly be there. Others, one of them is the Justice Resource Institute, said that they may not be able to take on all the clients and all the employees, but they certainly are always looking for accomplished employees in that field. So hopefully things work out for them.
Hmm. Let's talk now about a story out of Falmouth, which is that the Falmouth police chief is looking for an exemption so that he can stay on the job past his 65th birthday.
That's right, Steve. In Massachusetts, police officers, firefighters, mandatory retirement age is 65. Longtime Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dunn is 63. He'll be 63 in June. His contract is up in 2019. He would like to stay on a little longer. If he signs a contract in 2019 for 3 years, then of course that would put him over the age. So he's asked the town manager to work in putting together a question for the town meeting coming up to send a home rule petition through our local legislators up to Beacon Hill. And they can do that. There is a provision that allows local fire chiefs and police chiefs, et cetera, to extend their retirement age if town meeting approves that, to allow the selectmen to submit a home rule petition to the state legislature.
So the state has to approve whether town is allowed to keep a firefighter or a police official past the age of 65.
Yep, it certainly does. And the draft article as it stands right now would allow Chief Dunn to serve until the end of June in 2024, which would put him at 69 years of age. If this is approved and there is the extension through 2024, they will evaluate his physical and mental fitness every year.
Sounds like the town is very happy to push to extend chief's contract. They believe that he's got plenty of energy and enthusiasm for
this
position.
Exactly.
We are going to speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you had a sad story this week. A high school student died in a car accident at the end of last week. The island community really anguished by this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a week of mourning and a really hard week for a lot of people, you know, in different parts of the island. And like you said, this extends from a single car accident just before 8 a.m. last Friday in Chilmark. And police said it appeared that a Chevy Blazer veered off the road on Middle Road, might have hit a tree and landed in some brush. And the driver, was Jake Baird, who was a 17-year-old high school senior, lived in Oak Bluffs, and police said he died at the scene, you know, despite the emergency efforts to respond. And there were two passengers in the car, a 19-year-old man from Aquinnah and a 16-year-old girl from Oak Bluffs, who was also a student at the high school, and they were taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. It sounds like they were not seriously injured, and their names aren't being released by police. And the cause of the crash is under investigation by state police. It takes a while for them to do that, so that's still ongoing. But really, since then, the loss has really rippled out to lots of different parts of the Vineyard, from his family to other people that knew him, and just a lot of different ways. He was a member of the Wampanoag tribe here, and throughout the week, a sacred fire burned at the home of his aunt and uncle, Jesse Little Doe Baird and Jason Baird, which is a tribal ritual, and the fire was tended round the clock with family and friends visiting. Yesterday, there was a gathering, kind of a visiting hours, at the Agricultural Hall in West Tisbury, which had a big turnout. He was remembered by his coworkers at Vineyard Gardens in West Tisbury, where they said he was, you know, loved by customers and the staff there. His friends at Alex's place at the YMCA gathered. It's a teen center. They gathered last weekend and remembered him as, you know, skilled at improv. They remembered his best jokes and his skill in that. And really, too, at the high school, there's been a memorial set up there with pictures and flowers, a defense there, also at the accident site. But the high school community is really dealing with this loss. And last Friday was actually a day off of school. It was a professional development day, but pretty quickly the high school reached out to the community and said, you know, they'd had counselors available and that students, parents, staff, teachers could gather at the high school. They're open Friday afternoon to be together and to remember Jake. And it sounds like there was a really big turnout. A lot of people came through and to be together and to remember him, and that continued throughout the weekend and this week. On Tuesday, midterm exams are postponed just so they could have a day to be together the first school day after the crash. And he was remembered also at Project Vine, which is kind of the alternative program that he was a part of. He was studying auto mechanics, and actually last Thursday he had a kind of a mini graduation ceremony of sorts with some other classmates in that program, because it was the end of the semester and he was headed off to do work study for the second semester. So they had a ceremony, and he received, I guess, the Renaissance Man Award for his skill with words and cars and numbers. And his teacher said, you know, he really went above and beyond. He was inquisitive. He was a talented writer, dedicated student. And they were really thought he was full of potential. And everyone, you know, felt the loss in that way, too. And the high school really, you could tell, was in different quarters in different ways really grappling with this. But, you know, all of us here, we've talked to a lot of people about him in the last week. And, you know, to a person, they all said, you know, he was a wonderful person. He made people feel welcome. The principal at the high school said she doesn't get to know every student, but she knew him because he stood out to her as a warm person with a big heart. So there's been in a lot of different ways people grappling with this week, and I'm sure that will continue in the coming weeks, and people will find different ways to honor him.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And joining us on the phone right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, historic districts can add value to a town by preserving history and character, but they can also be limitations. You've got two stories this week about the challenges around historic districts. Let's start in Chatham.
Sure. Several months ago, after proposing two new historic districts in Chatham, the Historical Commission here this week decided to drop its effort to create a district in the Stage Harbor Road neighborhood. Now, they took a poll of the 47 property owners that were within the designated area that they had chosen, and 31 of the property owners opposed the a nomination. And without the support of property owners, a nomination can't go through. The Mass Historical Commission, which is charged with making the determination before forwarding it to the National Park Service, will not go ahead if a majority of the residents or property owners on an area don't favor it. And that's what happens here. But commission members said, you know, this really doesn't diminish the historical value of the street. It's considered one of the oldest in town, with more than 30 18th and 19th century homes. But lately, it's been sort of an epicenter of controversy, with a couple of proposals to demolish historic homes that are under demolition delay, and that's caused some tension within the neighborhood. A few of the residents had favored a district a few years ago, but then the town proposed a sidewalk down the road, and after the town dropped the sidewalk idea in the face of opposition, the historic district thought they'd come in and do a historic district nomination, but that didn't go over well with the neighbors. And there've also been some anecdotal evidence that this process has resulted in some sales of property in the area that were lower than the assessed value, which the neighbors point to as saying that this historic district idea is not what they expected. Now, the Chatham Historic District has got one other historic National Historic District nomination on their plate, and that's for South Chatham. And they said this week that they're going to go ahead and continue to explore that.
Now, meanwhile, the town of Orleans is also exploring historic district options.
Yeah, we were surprised to realize that Orleans is really, I think, one of the few area towns that doesn't have any historic districts.
I was surprised to learn that, yes.
Yeah, the only real historic district they have is a portion of the old Kings Highway district along Route 6A, and that's really just a small portion of that much larger district. Now, earlier this month, the town's historic district met with consultant Eric Dre to discuss options in developing historic districts in town. And they're looking at a range of options, including a local historic district, an architectural preservation district, or even national register district that Chatham has been looking at. And they do have the authority to impose demolition delays like Chatham and a lot of other communities have. But there are some areas they feel have significant historical integrity, and they want to try to have an extra level of protection. Right now, they're really looking to start small. They've been examining sort of a triangle of historic structures along Main Street, including the Orleans Federated Church, the Academy Playhouse, and the Orleans Historical Society's Meeting House. And that could easily be expanded down Main Street, stretching east towards the Barley Neck Inn. There's a whole row of old historic homes down that area. And the commission, right now, they're going to continue working with Dre to try to refine that idea, but they also want to have some buy-in from the community, and so they're trying to gauge what one commission member called the temperature of the town on this issue, and they'll continue to do that and develop hopefully develop a proposal within the next few months.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the local news roundup. On the Point with us is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, your beat at the paper includes politics. You write the weekly political notes column. You have a piece this week about the Republican challenger to Congressman Bill Keating.
That's right, Steve. It's 2018. It's going to be a big election year, not only on the state level, but also for U.S. Senate races. And Bill Keating, who's our incumbent congressman here in the 9th District of Massachusetts, we'll have a fight on his hands. We spoke this week to Peter Tedeschi. He's a Republican from Marshfield, which is on the northern edge of the district up there on the South Shore. And if the name sounds familiar, you've probably ridden by many of his family's stores. He used to be the CEO of the family business, which was Tedeschi Food Shops, a convenience stores. I think they're now branded as 7-Eleven. He is off and running with his campaign. And he said that Congressman Keating may be vulnerable this year simply because he thinks a lot of people are tired of the gridlock that's happening in Washington, D.C., the lack of cooperation between the parties, lack of results. So that seems to be what his message will be moving forward here. Of course, we've got another 10 months before the election.
And any Republican candidate right now is asked his position or her position on the president, and this was no exception.
That's right. Had to ask him about that. And he said, well, it's hard to dispute that the economy is not doing well under President Trump. But he said, as far as tone and temperament of the president, he certainly is not in agreement with that, wishes that Trump would be more presidential and take more care in his words and communication.
Also, in your political notes column, you noted that this week that there is a fake Twitter account that has been set up for one of our county commissioners.
Yes, there is. And as many people may know, one of our county commissioners, one of the three of them, is Ronald Beatty Jr., Ron Beatty, known for his prolific use of Twitter. For most of the time, his tweets are very controversial. Just this year, he's been talking about killing the great white sharks. Had a little controversy with the Me Too movement, saying that it was nonsense. And most recently, he's been promoting the use of bounty hunters to go and look for immigrants here on the Cape and Islands. Well, last weekend, a Twitter account appeared called Fake Ron Beatty. It's got almost 100 followers, I believe, as of right now, and it calls itself a parody of the shark-slaying Barnstable Commissioner. And I reached out to Beatty earlier in this week to ask what he thought about that. He did block the fake account from viewing his tweets. He claims he couldn't care less about it and said if somebody wants to spend their time and energy on that, they can just go for it. He ended up his email message to me with God Bless America.
It's part of the circus aspect of social media.
That's right. This goes round and round,
and the circular aspect as well. I want to mention one other story, which is that the Cape Cod Commission is somewhat moving towards appointing an acting director. This is a little complicated.
They are, yes. Paul Nedzwicki, the longtime director, he's been there for more than a decade as the executive director of the commission. Early next month, he'll be moving on to take a similar post at the Southfield Redevelopment Authority, which is tasked with repurposing the former South Weymouth Air Base. And the executive committee of the commission met late last week and has made a recommendation that the current deputy director, a woman named Christy Senatori, be appointed the acting executive director of the Cape Cod Commission. The next step in this process will be to have it go in front of the Board of Commissioners at their meeting next Wednesday, and they would either decide to accept the recommendation or not to accept it. Not sure how it'll go right now, but Mr. Beatty, who we just spoke about, has been very vocal through his Twitter postings that he would rather see a search, see them cast a wide net for the next executive director. And he's referred several times to the appointment of someone inside the organization to the post as cronyism. So next Wednesday should be an interesting meeting once again at the county.
Let's move on here to a story about a popular bookstore in Falmouth. It's facing a challenge in getting a lot of community support after having to close for water damage.
Yeah, really beloved Falmouth bookstore, Steve. It's called The Eight Cousins, and it's on Main Street. And on January 9th, one of the owners walked in to open up the store, found that the ceiling had collapsed. There was a flood in the building. If you see some of the photos on their website, it's very sad to see. And a lot of their inventory was just destroyed. But it sounds like they are trying to get up and running and want to open up again in the spring. And they're asking some folks if they'd like to buy some gift cards so they could use them when it reopens. And that's on their website as well. And they've been able to salvage some equipment, which is a good thing. But right now, what we know, and according to what the folks at A Cousins are saying, it seems to be a plumbing malfunction and not related to that really cold weather snap that we had.
And it just has really wiped out their inventory.
It really did, yeah.
And it is in one of those stores that a lot of people view as an anchor along that stretch of Main Street and a real popular destination.
Been there since 1986.
We are going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, in Provincetown, folks still dealing with the aftermath of our January 4th storm, and it sounds as if it's had an impact on spending plans for the town as well. Tell us about this.
Yes, that's right. It's 2 weeks now since the nor'easter of January 4th, which caused really devastating flooding in low areas of downtown Provincetown. And people are still dealing with the aftermath of that. There are still wet basements. There are still electrical systems that aren't working. And some people are upset about it. A woman named Kaylin Davis went to the selectmen and said that she was pretty angry about the town's preparedness for this particular storm. So we talked to town officials, including Rich Waldo, who's the head of the Department of Public Works, and he explained that actually the town has been trying to prepare for a number of years. In 2014, Provincetown got a $100,000 grant from Coastal Zone Management to perform a risk assessment, and that was done with the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies and an engineering firm, Woodard and Curran. And they mapped out all the vulnerable areas, and the map, in fact, proved to be highly accurate. The problem is that the town then applied for another grant to fund a beach nourishment program that would build up areas of the waterfront beaches that have been subject to erosion, but they didn't get the grant. So the plan had been, up until this most recent storm, to ask for $75,000 at the upcoming annual town meeting in April, with the idea that that would be matching funds and the rest of the money needed for the beach nourishment program would come from grants. Now the town has decided to just go ahead and ask for the whole $200,000 that they think the project will cost. Waldo says that given this most recent storm, we don't want to gamble. So since they had been unsuccessful in this last cycle at getting another Coastal Zone Management grant, he says there just were too many projects in the queue and they didn't make the cut. So they're now talking about just funding it, just having the town pay for it. In the meantime, people are worried here because there's another supermoon that's coming on January 31st. You know, the reason for the huge storm surge on the 4th was that the nor'easter unluckily coincided with an astronomical high tide from the super full moon. And there's another full moon coming on the 31st of this month. And if there happens to be another big storm like that, this whole thing could happen again. People have been talking about the need for sandbags, and one of the adjunct scientists at the Center for Coastal Studies, Moncrief Cochran, told the Banner that he thought that a more extensive strategic placement of sandbags could have prevented a lot of the flooding damage. And in fact, the town does have a stockpile of 150 sandbags that they used that helped to keep water out of the basement of the town hall. But people are saying that there should be a lot more of them. They should be made available to residents. And that apparently is also in the works.
Ed, I want to ask you briefly about another story you have about the principal of Provincetown schools leaving. You describe this as happening abruptly. She's been there for a while.
Yes, this is Kim Pike, who's been the principal of the Provincetown schools. The local system is pre-K through eighth grade. She's been the principal for the past 8.5 years, and it's been a very stable administration there. But Ms. Pike announced on January 9th that she was leaving to take another job, and her last day is actually today, January 19th. So this caught pretty much everybody by surprise, although the superintendent, Beth Singer, told us that it wasn't a surprise to her, that she knew that the principal was applying for this other job and had been supportive of her. And she says everything's going to be fine. Administrators come and go. And they've already identified someone here in town who will be the interim principal for the rest of this school year, Jeff Slater Cote, who actually is a retired principal who has worked in Boston and in California, and moved to town not too long ago to run a bed and breakfast, and he's agreed to step in and fill the gap until they can identify a new permanent principal, which they're going to do through a nationwide search.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Always good to be with you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And on the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is Barry Stringfellow. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Steve.
Barry, you have a story about a psychic who's been sentenced for cheating of a Chilmark woman out of $3.5 million. Tell us about this.
Well, it's a big time crime that was sniffed out by a small town cop, and the story, it's gained national attention. And like you said, she bilked a Chilmark woman out of $3.5 million. And the woman, Sally Johnson, was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Boston on Wednesday to 26 months in prison. She was also ordered to repay more than the $3.5 million, and she also has to pay the IRS over $700,000. But the scam went from 2007 to 2014. And
7 years this went on.
Yes, yes. And it was uncovered by Chilmark Police Sergeant Sean Slavin in November 2013. And the woman had called and reported she'd been robbed by a housekeeper, and the sergeant later found out that that wasn't credible, and he interviewed the woman, and she showed behavior consistent with Alzheimer's. And the woman told the sergeant that she was in process of moving, but it was stalled because she was waiting for the healer to get rid of the demons out of the house. And she thought she'd been robbed for about $20,000. The sergeant contacted her brother, who thought it was more like $150,000. At the end of the day, they found out it was over $3.5 million. And then the sergeant tried to pursue it at the district court level. When that didn't get anywhere, he passed the investigation along to the FBI. And then the FBI took the lead, but it was clear that the sergeant's detective work and his meticulous investigation led to the arrest of the woman. And it really hits home, too, because there's a considerable elderly population here in the island, like on the Cape, and the population is growing, and the number of scans are growing. So it was, some good work by Sergeant Slavin.
It's hard to believe that a woman who's so that anybody going through dementia or approaching that has control of this much money to let it slip away over a period of 7 years. It's quite a story.
Yes, it is, and it's hard to believe that somebody, could be that cruel over
yes.
7 years to take that much of the woman's money.
Yes. You have another story, Barry, about birders with cameras and the treasures that they find on the island.
Yes, well, our nature columnist, Matt Pelican, has said that, our location being just off the mainland, we wind up with a lot of, disoriented migrants, and in that sense, we wind up with some extremely rare birds. And birding is big here. The MV Bird Alert has 1,500 members, which is about that's a Facebook page, which is about 10% of our year-round population. And we just got the bird count in from December 29th. Over 23,000 birds were counted, 119 species in one day. But the big kahuna here is the spectacular snowy owl, and it's at least one shows up every year. And in the bird count, there were 10 counted, three bald eagles and short-eared owls, which are pretty rare. One of the things they're also trying to stress with this is, a lot of people are taking pictures, and they just ask people also to just try to keep a distance, invest in some good lenses, but keep a distance so the birds aren't disturbed. But it's quite an exciting time here in the winter. It's one of the things we can do.
Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Barry, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
I am Steve Junker. This is the Local News Roundup. With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. And Jeff, word out that after almost half a century as an annual tradition, the Cape Cod Scallop Festival will not happen this year.
That's right, Steve. It started back in 1969. The Scallop Festival, as we know it, is done, at least for now. And it is an event, yearly event, happens in late September, put on by the Cape Cod Canal Chamber of Commerce. And we reached out to the director, Maria Oliva, this week, said it was a very risky and expensive venture. And for those who aren't familiar with the Scallop Festival, it had always been held in Buzzards Bay, right there on Main Street. And in 2014, because they've had some flooding and issues with winds with the tents in Buzzards Bay, it was moved to the Cape Cod Fairgrounds on Route 151 in East Falmouth, much larger venue. It became a three-day event with arts and crafts and midway entertainment. A car show became quite a big event. A lot of people didn't like that. They thought it lost, really lost what it was all about. When it started out, it was an event for scallopers to kind of like get rid of some of their catch. And last year, I think, was really the death knell, this 2017 event, when two out of the 3 days were pretty much wiped out due to the remnants of Hurricane Jose, if you remember that. We had quite a string of rainy, windy days. And I got to tell you, I went on one of those days, and it was a big mud bowl. Mm-hmm. It really was. And so I'm guessing that there was quite a bit of financial loss there as well. But for many years, this event was one of the top 100 bus tour stops in the United States, and that was according to the American Bus Association. And all is not lost, apparently. The Chamber of Commerce up there says the options are still open for 2019.
So it may come back, but right now looking like it's not happening this year, that's for sure. Not as a three-day.
That's right. And I guess I'm guessing it will come back in a different iteration.
Mm-hmm. You have an article out this week detailing some of the work of the Cape Cod Compact. This is really an advocacy group for power customers on the Cape and the Vineyard.
It is. It's a municipal aggregator. The Cape Light Compact, which was formed in 1997, has about 139 customers here on the Cape. Last year, July 1st, as a matter of fact, it broke off from its 20-year fiscal administrative relationship with Barnstable County. It's now an independent entity, and we checked in to see what they were up to. I went to visit their new offices last week. And they've had a very busy year so far, really spending a lot of time advocating for ratepayers here on the Cape and Martha's Vineyard against some utility price hikes. Eversource had a big-time rate case that was recently resolved. There was a decision on that.
They were looking for a big increase.
Yeah, it was a $56 million rate hike by Eversource. The Cape Light Compact was very involved in that case, filed brief upon brief upon brief, and
the
really did have an impact.
Advocating for consumers
to
lessen that
like,
increase.
Yeah, you know, yeah. This is way over the top here. And when all was said and done, the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities granted Eversource only a $12.2 million rate increase, which is a 78% decrease. And the compact was very involved in that. And that 12.2 could even go lower in the coming weeks because Eversource has said they will take into consideration the amount of taxes they'll be saving with the new tax plan out of D.C.
Now, the Cape Light Compact also still facing some having separated from the county, mm-hmm. and there's still some changes going on there about the way they even enroll customers.
That's right. And this is an appeal that was filed last week with the Department of Public Utilities here in Massachusetts. From my understanding, you used to start a new electric service here on Cape in the Vineyard. You'd automatically become a customer of the Cape Light Compact. That's not the case anymore. You begin to initiate service, whether it be a new home or you move. You're going to be subscribing to basic service from the utility. So it will be up to the Cape Light Compact to reach out to you to make that change. So you're going to have to make an effort to become a part of the aggregation plan.
Jeff, I want to talk to you about Barnstable County because this is one of the areas that you cover. It's one of your beats. Barnstable County officials have been looking at some suggestions for restructuring county government for some while now, and they looked at another one, and once again, they passed on this proposal. Can you explain a little bit of this for us?
Sure, and the history of these restructuring efforts certainly predate my covering the county. But the Assembly of Delegates, which is a legislative body of the county government, that each town has a delegate, decided at its meeting Wednesday not to take action on a proposal to expand the number of county commissioners from 3 to 5 members. Nothing new. The same thing was proposed in 2013, although in 2013 it was approved by the Assembly. It just didn't go any further because at that time there was a comprehensive review of county government going on, and it just stopped there. But some of the reasons why this was proposed this time, and it was just pretty much the same ordinance that was proposed back in 2013, was the smaller districts. It was proposing the commissioners come from 5 districts on the Cape, representing about 20% of the population, and that would allow candidates the time to really meet and know the people in those towns, be a little less cumbersome than having to run for office for the entire Cape. And also, right now, with the Massachusetts open meeting law, the 3 commissioners can't speak with each other unless it's in a meeting.
Because any two...
Any two would be a quorum. Yeah, so it's very difficult. They only address issues when they're meeting once a week, but it did not pass. And so, Leo Kakunis.
On the surface of what you just explained, which is making the commission bigger for this wide region, makes sense. Why did it not pass? What were some of the concerns?
Yeah, well, Leo Kakunis, who ironically initially proposed this back in 2013 when he was not a county commissioner.
And who is a county commissioner now.
He was saying there's just too many unanswered questions. Can you really cleanly break up these districts? The proposal, for instance, was Falmouth and Mashpee would be one district, Bourne and Sandwich, but you're going to have to tweak that. We need a few more details. How are you going to deal with the people who are in office now? How are those terms going to overlap? And there were quite a few issues that just weren't part of that plan. And I think that his argument resonated with the Assembly.
Story in today's paper, Jeff, about a new policy of the Steamship Authority for its ferries. It has to do with what programs can be on the televisions.
It does, and this is reflective of the political environment we have in the United States right now, Steve. At its meeting this week, the Steamship Authority Board approved a new policy prohibiting cable news networks, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, from being shown either on its ferries or in its terminal locations due to passenger complaints over the past year.
So they were hearing from passengers.
They were hearing
this.
From passengers who may have got on the ferry and saw Fox News, didn't want to see it, or somebody wanted to MSNBC. So now the new policy is that the televisions must be tuned to local news. First option is New England cable news, if they are running news. Then it goes to sports or non-controversial programming, such as the Weather Channel, Food Network, or Discovery Channel. And it was in today's story, one of the members of the representative from Falmouth said, it's a sporting event. So if you think about it, if it's a New York versus Boston football or baseball game, that could be equally as controversial. And there will be no more cable news network on networks on the steamships. And I also noticed a story out of Boston last week that there was a chain of gyms up there did the same thing.
Mm. Casey Myers, your reporter there at the Cape Cod Times, had a story this week about the tiny home movement. We've heard a lot about the tiny home movement over the last couple of years. She took a look at why it hasn't taken off for the Cape and Islands, and it turns out there's a lot of regulations against
it. That's right. There's been a lot of buzz about tiny homes over the past few years. And Nantucket even passed a bylaw in 2016 saying that the tiny homes are welcome there, but none have been permitted because of state building codes. Same thing here on the Cape and Islands. And KC spoke with a woman from Provincetown, a woman named Dana Hope, who bought one, said that was really her only shot of owning a home in Provincetown, given the prices there. But the Board of Selectmen in Provincetown said, you know, this is unrealistic. They're not connected. You can't connect them to sewers, electricity, or water. And so it's still sitting in a lot outside of Provincetown where recreational vehicles sit. Even though this woman said she was going to rebuild the home, which she bought for, I want to say, $16,000 in Vermont. Quite a deal for a place in Provincetown. Said she was going to put a composting toilet in there, have rain barrels, solar panels, and really be off the grid, but still no dice for her. In speaking with the Cape Cod Commission, one of the folks there, Heather Harper, who works with housing issues, said they could be considered mobile homes, but then you have another problem. There's not many Cape towns allow mobile home parks. Mm-hmm. So she said we were probably better off taking a look at changing bylaws to allow accessory dwellings to solve some of the problem right now.
The Cape Cod Commission wasn't going to go to bat for tiny homes.
No.
It sounded like they were going to work on other
accessory dwellings.
Yes.
And, yeah.
A story from Doug Frazier this week about a couple of bills at the State House looking to phase out commercial fishing of striped bass in Massachusetts. Explain this for us.
Yeah, you know, striped bass, very popular fish here, large demand for it, especially during the summer season, and especially now since haddock and cod have been fished out inshore. There's two bills right now before the Mass State Legislature that want to ban commercial sale and harvesting of striped bass, except if you're a fisherman who averaged about 1,000 pounds for the previous 5 years. So it's not, they don't want to put you out of business. They just don't want any new fishermen to come in here. And that would that particular permit that you'd get would be phased out when you die or stop fishing. And this was brought on by a group called Stripers Forever, which is based, I want to say, in South Portland, Maine. And they think removing the commercial fishing of striped bass would leave more fish available for the average people, those who want to go out and fish, get one for dinner, et cetera. And they're saying, hey, this bill is kind. It allows these legitimate commercial fishermen to have many more years of doing what they're doing. But the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, mm-hmm. so many commissions involved in fisheries, say, hey, you know, if you take a look at the numbers of striped bass caught, the recreational fishers have a much greater impact than the commercial fishermen with this particular fish. The bill right now is with the Joint Committee on Environmental Natural Resources Agriculture on Beacon Hill. And so we'll have to see in the next coming weeks and months whether it moves out of committee. But Senator Julian Sear represents most of Cape Cod and the islands, said he does not support this. Mm-hmm. He said our striped bass fishery is amongst one of the best fisheries managed in the country.
It's a conversation that's come up again and again in the past.
I guess this happens year after year.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention a nice story about a Bourne resident who's a fixture at Selectmen's meetings. We have just a minute here, but
sure.
He's been there a long, long time.
Yeah, his name's James Mulvey. He's 94 years old. If you've been to town meetings and boards and commissions, as his reporters are inclined to do, once in a while, there's somebody who just comes in and wants to take it all in, and this is one of those folks. He said he can't remember the last time he's missed a Board of Selectmen meeting, and he said he cares about the town and wants to be informed. And the Board of Selectmen's room is even named after him, Steve, the James A. Mulvey Meeting Room. And they say when he speaks, he doesn't want to argue with the selectmen. He just wants to make things better. So
that's great.
Good role model for those who want to be involved in town government.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times.
Thank you,
Jeff. And thank my our contributors, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Steve Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.